Welcome to Mind Styling, the podcast that explores how we can win at the game inside our heads and make a mark on this world in our own unique style, on our own terms.
We interview entrepreneurs and leaders who aren't afraid to push the boundaries and set their own definitions of success. We will share with you the tips and techniques they use to style their mind and give you the tools you need to start mind styling for yourself.
Hello, Mind Stylists, and welcome to today's episode of Mind Styling. Amy and I are so happy today to be joined by Katie Vanek-Smith. She's the co-founder and publisher of Tortoise Media with James Harding and Matthew Barzan. Tortoise is a slow media news platform that is committed to looking at what is driving the news and is built on a membership model that is inclusive and open. Prior to the new adventure as an entrepreneur, Katie was the president of Dow Jones and publisher of the Wall Street Journal, where she led the company to over 3 million subscribers, the largest number in Wall Street Journal history. She's previously worked at the Telegraph Media Group and The Times, where as chief marketing officer, she was the architect of the newspaper's early move to paid digital subscriptions. She created the UK's first news membership brand, Times Plus, and oversaw the events programs, including both the Wall Street Journal CEO Council and the Times CEO Summit. She was named Pioneer of the Year at British Media Awards. She is a vice patron of the charity Family Action and strategic advisor to Big Change. But I know Katie doesn't really like to look backwards, so we'll be in the moment. Welcome, Katie. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. And thanks for having me. It's lovely to see you or meet you, and even better to see Amy.
Yay.
First question we always have for everybody, which is, could you tell us a little bit about the entrepreneurial journey? How was Tortoise conceptualized, and how have you got to where you are now?
Well, I think from the intro, everyone will realize that I'm quite late to entrepreneurialism. So you gave me a very, very kind introduction, but you also gave a very good sense of the fact that I've spent most of my career in the corporate world. And I think that it's not a normal path to entrepreneurialism. It wasn't a normal path to end up working in media. And I think that I would say a couple of things. I fell into media. When I graduated from university, where I was with Amy, that's how I know Amy. When I graduated from university, I went and lived in Japan. I taught English for a year. I did it to pay off my student debts, which were quite large, even though in those days you still had grants. I'm sort of showing our age a bit, Amy. I'm sorry for that.
No, don't.
I know, it's awkward, isn't it? Anyway, and when I came back, I was dating, you'll remember this, Amy, I was dating a guy called Guy. And his mother was a bit annoyed with me because I was like, living with her son and, you know, not paying my way. So bless old Mavis. I love Mavis, but she kept cutting out job ads for me from the paper. And one day she left this job ad in front of me at breakfast, which was opportunities for graduates in sales and marketing at the Times newspapers. And so I thought, well, I'll just do that. I'll just get her off my back. I'll go and apply for that. So I did it. And it was a bit like an episode of X Factor, in the way that only News Corp can possibly behave, which is there were sort of 80 of us in the room at the beginning of the day. We turn up as 80 people. They say, right, we're going to do some sort of, we're going to watch you. It's like some sort of live monkey experiment in a sort of room. We're going to watch you in all these different things we're going to ask you to do. And then we're going to have some lunch. So we did this morning of sort of team working, all these different things. And then we had lunch, and then they said, and after lunch, we're going to read out 9 names and the rest of you can go home. Yeah, brutal. So we, I was one of the 9 names. They then interviewed us, and then they gave 5 of us a sort of a 6-month job, at which they said at the end of it, there'll be 2 people that will be given a job. So it was quite brutal, quite News Corp, quite enjoyable, actually. And what I sort of found in that process was that, you know, I ended up in this job. I had no idea whether it was the right job for me. And it turns out it wasn't to begin with, because they put me in advertising sales. And I was shit at it to begin with. And I hated it. And I went and resigned on my second week and said, look, this is terrible. Go give the job to someone else. And this wonderful woman in HR, wonderful woman called Leslie Webb, said, oh, you studied history at university. why don't you go and spend a day in the archives? You know, root yourself in this business. So I said, okay, fine, I'll do that. Anything's better than selling advertising. So I spent a day in the archive with a wonderful man called Eamon, who unlocked all the treasure trove that was the Times' archive. And he sort of said to me, what are you interested in? And I said, well, trains, because I'd had a really bad commute into work that day. They hadn't run on time. There'd been leaves on the line or some other such nonsense that we always get for late running trains. And where the Times has been there or shaped history. And he said, go away. Go get yourself a coffee in the canteen. Come back. I go back half an hour later and he's got this amazing stuff out of the archive. This is going somewhere, by the way. And he's got this whole pile of letters, this, you know, a big pile of letters and one singular letter. And this big pile of letters were all written by Charles Dickens to the editor of the Times to complain about the state of British railways, none of which had ever been published, right? I mean, it was just his hobby horse, right? And then there was this one letter. And when you opened it, you could see it was by an illiterate hand. It was very badly written. It was sort of phonetic. It sort of, but this letter actually did get published. And the story behind this letter was that there was a man who was the farm labourer fiancé of a girl that worked in service at the big house in the village. And the girl that worked in service, the lord of the manor, would read the Times to them every morning to educate them. And he'd read a story about how there'd been a head-on collision of two trains and scores of people had died. And she went home and told this story to her fiancé, who the next day, whilst working in the on the farm, sort of had a sort of light bulb moment and drew a blueprint, and a blueprint that was the blueprint for his idea of a signalling system. This then got sent in to the Times, published in the Times, and is the blueprint of the United Kingdom's railway system.
Oh, you're just giving me goose pimples.
So having gone, oh my God, this is the worst job I've ever had, I also then sort of was like, but I'm working in the most amazing industry. There were lots of other amazing things there. There was Florence Nightingale's lamp from the Crimea, because Woolley Russell was the first ever embedded war correspondent. He went off to Crimea. And it was the Times readers that raised the money to send Florence there, because she read the reports in the Times. It was a treasure trove. It was unbelievable. And Eamon said to me, right as I was leaving, I'd had this day in the archive, and he said, well, you know, the Times doesn't make money. And the Times had been published since 1785, first as the Daily Universal Register, then in 1788 as the Times, but it had never made money. And it's only through the fact that it had countless proprietors that were prepared to invest in and support journalism as a pillar of democracy and free speech and all the things that we know that are kind of fair and important press and the fourth estate, as it's known in the industry, is there for. And I just was sort of a little thing went off in my head, which was, oh, it'd be quite cool, wouldn't it, to be here and be part of the team that kind of gets to make the Times profitable, right? And, you know, this sort of, oh, I'd quite like to be part of that, because I love the Times. I love what it stands for. I love journalism. I fell in love with the journalism working there. But just that thought that, you know, it was such a great brand, such an important part of our democratic society, but it doesn't make money. I come from a family where, you know, we like making money, right? We're quite entrepreneurial in that sense of my dad used to run a bingo and amusements arcades, and we're sort of a bit wheelie dealery, you could say pikey. But I'd rather not. I got inspired to work there. And then I did then spend the next 15 years working in the Times and Sunday Times, little sojourn to the Telegraph, that doesn't really count, and in News Corp. And I found myself building the digital business very early on, seeing, you know, I ran Times Online from the year 2000 just because I was 27 and the editor was like, you're young, you'll understand this stuff. I'm like, I don't understand it. He's like, yeah, but you're young, you'll figure it out. I'm like, cool, thanks. But it was very obvious very early on that the business model was broken, And it was not going to work for journalism, and it was not going to work for media, because you could just see the cost per thousand of advertising declining. You could see these other big players. Back then it was Yahoo and AOL. It wasn't Google and Facebook, but you could see these big platforms emerging. And you could just see that if consumers could read it for free and the ad numbers were going down, this wasn't going anywhere good. So in the year 2004, I tried to get the Times to be paid for digitally, and I got laughed out of the room. But the great thing about News Corp is it's a really, there are lots of things about News Corp that from the outside in people don't like, but in News Corp, culturally, it's an amazing place to work. It was a very entrepreneurial culture. I didn't know this at the time, right? I didn't know it was an entrepreneurial culture, but it was a really entrepreneurial culture. There was a sort of dog-eat-dog nature to it. You needed the skin of a rhinoceros, you know, because if you were prepared to put your head above the parapet and say, I believe in this, you know, people kind of secretly wanted you to fail, right? But, you know, if you were a success, they were like, oh, yeah, that was brilliant. So I'm, as Amy knows, I really don't care what people think about me. So I was quite happy to sort of allow people to think that I might fail. If I was quite excited by it and wanted to passionately do something, I'd fight for it. And so I really, really fought for the paywall of the Times. It took me probably 8 years to get the paywall up. I'm quite like a dog with a bone when I believe in something. And we got the paywall up in 2010, finally, on the Times. And in 2013, the Times made money for the first time in its history. So,
well done.
From that, I went to the Wall Street Journal because it was part of News Corp. Again, it had a challenge. News Corp had bought the paper in 2007. You know, it's an amazing brand, an amazing business, but it wasn't growing. And went in and was part of a team that kind of, you know, brought all of the revenue lines back into growth. And that was great. It was a sort of more of a traditional corporate experience, actually. And I missed the kind of News Corp entrepreneurial, defy conventional wisdoms, if it can't be done, let's try even harder to do it. And, you know, combination of the journal not being of News Corp, it was a News Corp acquisition, so its culture was quite different. And also post phone hacking, let's be honest, I worked on the cleanup of post phone hacking, and the fact that that changes a culture. Right, you have to address the issues that allow that bad behavior to come in, and some of that was innate in the kind of DNA of the fact we were very entrepreneurial. So, you know, it did. There were some bad things that got through and shouldn't have. So, I hadn't really known that I was, if you like, in a really entrepreneurial corporate culture. I didn't know that, and I never thought I would do my own thing. Because I grew up, you know, in a single parent household. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. Mum was on benefits. And I just never thought an entrepreneurial career would be the option for me, given that financial security is a really big thing. And so entrepreneurs, I was like, oh, wow, you're going to have to give up all of this, all of that. Anyway, I just got to the point where I was in my 40s. I'd said to myself, in my career, my 20s, I'll figure out what I'm good at. In my 30s, I'll build that network. In my 40s, I'll make the money, pay off my mortgage. And in my 50s, I'll go and do the thing I really believe in, right? And I always thought that was teaching. I was going to have my own school. You know, I was always lining up people I worked with as history teachers or maths teachers or whatever along the way, and, you know, building this sort of group of people. But by the way, we'd all be decrepit and no kid would ever want to be taught by us. But I thought it was the right thing. And I suddenly had a light bulb moment when James, who is my co-founder, and I met at the time. So he was part of that paywall journey. So he was the editor. I was the CMO. James called me. He'd been 5 years at the BBC. I was at the Wall Street Journal in New York. And he said, I've got an idea. It's called Tortoise. Are you over in England anytime soon? Can we have a drink? And I was like, yeah, sure. So we had the drink. He told me his idea. I really loved it. I slightly changed his idea. And then he went and raised a first investor. And the investor said, love the idea. It's much better than the first one. I was like, thanks. And I'll give you the money, but who's your business partner? And so James calls me. he's like, obviously, I'm not going to try and tempt you out of the Wall Street Journal. You've got the biggest job in the world. You're the president of that. I'm like, yeah. What do you want? Can you find me someone? And I was like, yeah, of course I will. And then I thought about it, and it took me probably about 2 weeks. I was like, I don't want anyone else doing that. I want to go do that. Mm. And so the thing I thought would be the thing I did in my 50s, which was, you know, that sort of idea, go and do the thing you should have always done. All of that is a very long way of answering how I got to where and to being on an entrepreneur's journey. It's basically, I know this. I know that I love what I do. Sort of journalism, you know, the sort of idea that it really matters. I love it. I think my entire career has been about creating a sustainable model for journalism. I just didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And then I find myself in a position where I've done it twice and this new model comes along. And I'm like, I really believe in that. And I think we need more sustainable models in journalism. There can't just be one. And I wasn't quite 50, hadn't paid off my mortgage. I wasn't as financially secure as I thought maybe I would have been to kind of take the risks. But you know what? You only get these chances sometimes once, and I'm okay. I've had a brilliant 25-year corporate career. I'm not sort of struggling. And, you know, there's a point at which you know that how to get through, you know how you can survive even if you don't know what the answer is. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, all those things just came together. And then I found myself co-founding Tortoise 2 years ago.
Brilliant. It's fantastic though, isn't it? And that idea of the entrepreneur within the large corporate because your story at the start, I mean, a large corporate with such depth of history. And the culture changes you were talking about and alluding to, and the shifts, because I would imagine, I mean, yes, I know that you have the most incredible thick skin, and actually you've always struck me as rather enjoying any challenges. And I don't know, you might just disavow me of that. But actually to really be there turning a business model around that probably really didn't want to be turned around. I mean, I can't imagine that the passion was there. And then now to be starting from scratch. So you must have had, you talked about that culture shift. You must have had some really interesting times to now with you and James to be creating that culture of Tortoise from scratch.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So I like to have work, I like to have like little mottos, because what you realize is it's quite, you know, I know where I get my energy from, and I know, you know, that my energy is slightly higher than other people's, maybe not quite as high as yours, Amy, but higher than most people's. And, you know, and I know how to maintain that energy, and I know how to bring it into other things. But, you know, you learn that, right? Mm. And so one of my mottos is work hard, have fun, make history. And so, you know, it is about that balance, right? Which is, you know, I'm not scared of hard work. You know, in fact, I love hard work. I love challenge. I like it to feel difficult, because if it feels difficult, it feels valuable, right? And I don't mean difficult in emotionally difficult. I like intellectual challenge. I like difficult problems. I like to solve problems. There's always a solution. I hate people who come to you with the problem. Always come with a bloody answer, for God's sake. Never just tell me what the problem is, you know? And so I'm not scared of hard work. In fact, I like it. And I get a real satisfaction out of sort of working hard. But I also really like to play hard. And Amy knows that very well. And so having the balance of that is really important. And this idea of making history, it really matters to me, right? Because I think, you know, we spend an inordinate amount of time at work. I've never even bothered to try and work out how much it is, because it might scare me a little bit. And so I think you have to, you know, you have to be doing something that you're passionate about. You have to get joy from what you do. And I know this sounds like a luxury, but I believe anyone can have it. My brother has it working in Sainsbury's as a baker. He gets so much joy from that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think everyone can get joy in the jobs that they do. And it's not a luxury to do a job that brings you joy, right? You just have to spend a bit of time knowing yourself and what brings you joy. So I think that, you know, I think it is absolutely fine to seek joy in that role. But in the, to go back to your work hard play, you know, I always look at work as well in this sort of culture piece about, and then how you take it to tortoise, you know, as work family, right? The teams you work with is like an extension of family. And I always say to my teams, look, I don't like everyone in my family. I mean, there are a lot of people I really dislike in my family, right? But they're my family and I always have their back. And so it doesn't matter that, you know, you don't have that personal relationship with people. It doesn't matter that you don't get on or gel with people. You're a family. You're in this together and you have each other's back. And so, you know, yes, news was pretty combative. It was very misogynistic when I joined. I got locked in a cupboard, as you know, Amy, in my first month, because I went to see the editor of the Times without permission of my boss, and I got locked in a cupboard.
You have to tell us that story properly, Katie.
I'm not very good at taking no for an answer if I think the other person's wrong, which tells you a lot about me. So I had been given, I'd gone from the six people on the 6 month probation, and I'd been given a job full time, and I'm now working in marketing on the Times. And I got given to this manager within the business, and I had literally been given to him, and I was like, well, what do you want me to do? And he was like, I don't know, whatever you want, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I mean, you're my boss, what do you think would be useful? And he was like, well, you're a recent graduate, aren't you? You know, why don't you look at student marketing? Why don't you go away and see what we should be doing in the student space? Fine. So I said, have I got a budget? He said, 75 grand. I said, fine, thanks very much. So I took my 75,000 budget, went away, researched it, found that we were number three student newspaper. The Guardian was number one. The Independent was number two. And the Times was number three at the time. Had my 75,000 budget. I then went around all the different departments. I went to the woman who ran classified advertising because she had a job section called First Job. I said, what do you do to market students? How do you get your audience? She gave me 200 grand. Nice. Kind of put into a student marketing plan. I then went to see the circulation director. Do you do stuff in campus shops? He gave me another 75. You know, I basically went around the whole business and met all these like leaders of their teams just to, hi, I'm Katie, I'm new, I'm, you know, da, da, da. Anyway, I ended up with 450 grand. It's a massive marketing budget. I wish I had that now. I mean, we're talking 25 years ago. If I had that now on Tortoise, I'd be rocking it. Anyway, I ended up with this massive marketing budget. And I thought, you know, I've got a strategy. I know what I'm going to do. I launched the first ever website for the Times. It was called 4D. But, you know, and I did all this other stuff and had the plan. And I was really excited. And I thought, but you know what? I've not spoken to the editor of the Times. I can't market the paper without knowing what he thinks about it. You're like the same. So I call up and I said, can I have a meeting with Peter, please? Peter Stossard, who was the editor at the time. And his PA said, yeah, come at 11 o'clock. So I go in. He says, oh, so, you know, welcome. I said, oh, thanks. I'm doing student marketing. Are you a recent student? Yes. Where did you go to university? Oxford University or Polytechnic University? What college? St. Hugh's. Oh, I used to bonk a girl at St. Hughes. I used to climb over the fence and off we went. Would you like a glass of whiskey? Oh, yeah, fine. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. Knock yourself out. Let's have a glass of whiskey. So we have a glass of whiskey. We have a lovely chat. Really, really kind, generous man. Gave me loads of insight into, you know, the paper, how it could be, its role, how he saw, you know, its role in, you know, for students and what was good about the paper and all that sort of stuff. So I wrote the strategy. Wrote it up, presented it to my boss, the man who sort of said, who are you? Why are you here? And his boss, they were like, oh, this is good. Yep, we like this. We'll go and present it to the editor. So I said, well, can I come? They said, no, you're far too junior. So they went and presented it. The editor said, what happened to that lovely girl, Katie Vanek, that came to see me? And they came back, came into the room. There was a wonderful woman called Ruth Laurent, who I worked with, amazing woman. She like really took me under her arm when I first turned up. She's like, you are in a lot of trouble. I was like, what? And she was like, they've come back from seeing Peter. I was like, oh. And then he says, the big boss, not my boss, the big boss, you, how dare you go against our what we asked? You get in that, see you next Tuesday cupboard now. it was called, I can't say it obviously because I've told, because I don't want to be explicit, but you know, the, and I wouldn't want to be explicitly rated on your little ratings of the podcast. But anyway, I just got told that at the beginning. I asked if I could swear, listeners, and I got told I could do what I liked, but I don't think we need to go there. But anyway, so that's what the cupboard was called. They locked me in it for 45 minutes. It was a stationery cupboard. I reorganized all the stationery and I got myself some nice post-its and a pen. Lovely. Lovely. Anyway, so that was my introduction to full-time work there. So you did need a bit of resilience, but, you know, along the way, there were some good stories, there were some bad stories. But the sort of work family is really important. And I think, you know, I always remember the first summer, just before we launched Tortoise, we had, and I'd left the Wall Street Journal, I'm back in the UK, and there was a small team of us. It was like the early team. There was about, I don't know, 10 of us. We came to my house in Sussex. I've got a summer house in the garden. And we spent a day, 2 days talking about Tortoise and what we thought it would be. And I told them all about my work family. I think they all look like I was a bit mental. But it stays with me. And so this opportunity to build a culture, you know, I worked in an environment where the editors were omnipotent and the commercial team was sort of the shit on the shoe, you know. Mm. And in order to be able to influence an editor, you had to learn a whole bunch of skills. You had to be resilient. You had to, you know, doubly prepare for every meeting. You had to read the paper back to front and know more about their paper and point out the mistakes in it, you know, have an opinion on what was in there. You know, you needed to earn their, not even not their respect. I mean, because everyone has to earn respect, right? Everyone has to earn trust. But you had to earn the sort of right to be there. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference. You had to earn the right to be there. And, you know, It takes a very long time, and you know, it was really tough. But I think, you know, the tutorial system that we went through at university was the best training for that ever, because, you know, you have to be able to think on your feet, you have to be able to argue from a different perspective. So all of the skills that, you know, you don't realize it at the time, the skills you're picking up along the way. But, you know, I also thought quite a lot, fuck you. If I didn't agree with them and I didn't believe in what they're, I would fight, right? So yeah, all that resilience, it taught me all those different things. But when I got the chance with James to build a culture that is Tortoise, you're really clear on what you don't want to bring in often and what you're against. I think it's more important to spend a bit of time thinking what you're for and what you're pro. Because if you define your culture about what you want to leave behind and the things that you're against, it's framed in a negative rather than something that you're building that's a positive. So for me, it really matters that we know what we're for, who we are and what we care about, rather than the things that we want to leave behind. Although I quite enjoyed all the stuff I left behind, but I'm a bit weird.
Let's just talk about that thick skin that you talked about quite a lot already. Can you say a little bit more about when did you discover that you had this thick skin? Is it something that you've carried with you throughout your life? Where do you think it developed from? And then you also mentioned some of those skills developed at Oxford. And could you say a little bit more about that? Because, of course, we've got lots of listeners. So they'll be coming from all sorts of different backgrounds, and some of them may be getting some experiences similar to the ones you've had, and some of them may never be exposed to those kind of experiences. So it'd be really good to hear about kind of how you think you nurtured that tool, which is so useful, because we will get knocked down. We do get knocked down. We do get no's all the time. You had to go for 8 years before you could, you know, get the times being paid for. That's a lot of knocking your head against a brick wall. Are there things you could tell our listeners about that and how you've developed it?
You need to meet my mother.
Okay.
Mrs. V, as she is known to all, is mother to many, but was, you know, is basically the backbone of, you know, that sort of early, and I think this comes from early childhood, and this comes from your experiences all the way through, right? This isn't something that, you know, that happened, you know, in my work life. You know, it's something, you know, that was instilled from a very early age, both in terms of, you know, Mrs. V and the role model she is, but also actually just my childhood experiences itself. So my mum is one of those people that, you know, if you, I always wanted a Cabbage Patch doll, definitely showing my age right here. I wasn't allowed one. And I wasn't allowed one because we couldn't afford one, right? But my mum never told me that was the reason I wasn't allowed one. Right? So I sort of weirdly went through life not realizing that we were not very wealthy until I was about 14, which you could probably say means I was a bit thick. Or you could say that my mother did an excellent job, right? And so, you know, but actually I should have realized it before then. So we went to, you know, we had this sort of whole run of like little mini life experiences that sort of every time they happened sort of probably reinforced the sort of, no, I'm going to go my own way. And, you know, it starts with Mrs. V's classic, which is, if everyone else had a shit sandwich for lunch, would you like one? Right. Which I now obviously say to my son, if everyone had a poo sandwich for lunch, would you like one? Because but you know, he's like, oh mum, this individual thing, yeah, okay. He's 10 and you know, it was that sort of, my mum did it because she had no choices, but actually she turned it into a positive about, you know, being different, being a good thing, being individual. So from a very early age, you know, all those sort of, you know, it's important to be individual. It's actually, you know, in our family, we celebrated being different. You know, not fitting in was a thing, right? And for my mum, it was probably a bunch of defense mechanisms from the fact that I couldn't fit in because, you know, we went to a convent school, right, from 3 till 11. So my primary school is a convent, a private convent school, which sounds like I came from privilege. But my parents then divorced when I was 10, 11, and sort of the world of ready money, which was sort of the amusements arcade bingo money, which was good in the summer, shit in the winter. You know, that sort of highs and lows of living. Some months were good, some months were bad. You had fish fingers every day. You know, all of that stuff, you don't really notice it at the time. You know, being told that you get fish fingers for Christmas dinner feels like a treat when you're 7. But it isn't a treat if you're the mum, right? But I never knew. We thought that was a treat. We were delighted, you know. So that whole sort of a bit of an economic sort of lows and highs, a mum that never really told you the kind of reasons behind it but protected you and gave you the skills to deal with it. The having a brother who's got Asperger's and would, you know, be picked on the estate we lived on, and sort of having that, you know, perspective of someone else's life, you know, and seeing it firsthand. And then getting a scholarship to a private school for secondary, absolutely hating every single minute of being at that school with a bunch of very nice girls who all wanted to be head girl and this girl who wanted to spend her life in the pub getting pissed. You know, it was, I never really fitted in, right? I was an outsider. And I was an outsider until I went to Oxford, so which weirdly it should have been the place where I was most outsider, right? So actually it was one of those things that sort of that early years of resilience of lack of money, parents getting divorced, you know, living on an estate where when we'd get off from our primary school with our nice felt hats, we'd get beaten up, you know, all of that, you know, and sort of learning how to cope with that from an early age with a positive outlook meant that when I got to Oxford, by the way, applying for Oxford, I got told I shouldn't apply for Oxford because I probably wasn't the type of person that should be allowed to go to Oxford by the school I was at, who tried to expel me once because I'd said fuck in the corridor. And they brought my mum into the school and my mum had a meeting with the headmistress. And all I could hear was my mum swearing back at the headmistress saying, don't tell me that you never fucking swear. Anyway, it was brilliant.
I feel like we need to send them this podcast.
Oh, well, I wasn't really on their list of high achieving students, I don't
alumni.
Although to be fair, they do write to me.
I was going
to
say, I bet they want you now.
Yeah. But I think they want anyone who's an alumni. And do you know what? It was an amazing education. I just didn't enjoy the school at all. It was just not right for me, but it was right for me, right? It wasn't right for me in terms of the most enjoyable 8 years of my life, but it was amazing in terms of what it gave me, from an educational standpoint, and it is the reason that I got into Oxford. But when I said I wanted to apply for Oxford, I got told, no, you're not one of those girls. And I said, well, actually, I'm going to. And, you know, they were sort of quite snooty about it. And in our day, you know, in my day, you got to do an entrance exam. And so you got to do the entrance exam, and you got given an offer at the end of it, right? So I went for went for my interview. This is a Shazam, but I've got to tell this one because it's a good one. And my mum had gone to Next and bought me an interview suit. Right. Classic.
Good old Next.
Good old Next. And it was, I remember it was teal. It was like a teal green, like nice, had nice fitted top. It was a pencil skirt. And when we got there, I was really like, I'd never sort of been in an environment like it. And the history tutors, of which all three were male, welcomed us, and they served us a really disgusting glass of red wine. But I was 17 and I was like, oh, I've never had a glass of wine. You know, it was like a big thing, right? Because I, you know, that was not the world I came from. So I'm having this disgusting, as it turns out, really rank glass of red wine. And, you know, they say in the warm up, so when you come for your interview tomorrow, we want you to be comfortable in the interview. There's a bunch of chairs in the room. Do you make sure you pick the one that you're going to be the most comfortable in? So I go into the room, and there's these three gentlemen on the interviewing panel. And there are 15 chairs in the room. It was George Barnes' office, Amy. It was like, you know, with the inflatable pink pterodactyl from the ceiling and the picture of Lenin on one wall and Stalin on the other. I mean, it was a welcoming environment. It was a welcoming environment. And so you're in this room and there's like 15 chairs. It's like a sort of chair maze. It's like the weirdest thing. And then there's his weird lung-shaped ashtray, which was just full of fag butts. I mean, a very welcoming environment. And I took a look at all these chairs and they were all super comfy and laid back. And I'm wearing this tight pencil skirt and I think, I can't. So I go and sit in the most puritanical church-like chair I can sit find.
The girl from the convent.
And he goes, why did you choose that chair? And I'm like, oh, because I didn't want you to see my knickers. And I do not remember anything else for the entirety of the interview. So I have actually no idea how I got in. I don't remember what we talked about. I just kept sitting there thinking, I've just told three men if I'd sat in another chair, they'd have been able to see my knickers. Great. Anyway, when I got in, they gave me a 2E offer. And that was transformative. I mean, you know, transform my life. I turn up at, you know, Oxford. I wasn't sure what to expect. You know, some people from my background, I know individuals, and they were friends of mine who didn't enjoy it, who found it really difficult, who found that transition from, you know, into just the sort of rarefied world that is, you know, difficult. I bloody loved it. And it was, I made some of the best friends of my life. It's where, you know, it's where everything changed, and it was just brilliant. And so so that's a very long story, because obviously what I like to do is just give you very long answers to your very nice questions. But it wasn't something that I knew was happening. It was the environment I grew up in. It was the role model that is my mum. And, you know, so when I turn up in these places, I just think I'm myself. I mean, like, you know, you tell me no, and I think, well, sod you, I'm going to prove you wrong. And it's all the way through my life. It's like, you can't do this. Well, I'm going to prove to you I can, you know. And it's all those little things. I mean, you know, there's no such word as can't. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. You know, if everyone had a poo sandwich for lunch, would you, you know, all of that, just with the kind of highs and lows of kind of not particularly great cash flow, then a divorce, single mom, you know, not fitting in, definitely was an outsider. So that when you turn up in environments where it's a bit of a battle, I'm like, great, bring it on.
Roll up your sleeves.
Oh, yeah.
You're incredibly loyal and passionate in your support of people that you rate. There must have been people in your team that you have mentored along the way. And brought up. What are your gems that you share with them if they're floundering a bit and struggling initially with, or consistently with, a challenging situation?
I mean, they're different for different people. So my what works for me doesn't necessarily work for others, right? I'm a massive passionate, I think early on, sort of in my 20s and 30s, I probably sponsored and sort of, you know, had the backs of more women than other people in my team. You know, I naturally felt that not everyone's Maggie Thatcher, right? I mean, I'm quite Maggie. I'm quite strident. I don't mind being in a room of only men. And doesn't bother me. I just get on with it. But I could see that a lot of really talented, exceptional, bright women weren't finding the News Corp environment quite as welcoming or as easy to navigate as perhaps I was. So I would say earlier on in my career, I probably mentored. I mean, I like to say sponsored because I, you know, the reality is you have such a privilege, you know, when you're successful yourself, the privilege starts to build for you. And mentoring's one thing, but sponsorships are completely different. And that's the taking an active role in people's careers and their lives. And I think this is this whole thing, which is you have to know the person as well as what they're trying to do. I mean, so I don't really see it as people's careers, I see it as their lives. And so I don't have one set of piece of advice that I would give to people because it's different for different people. But, you know, I suppose there are some common things that come out. And now particularly I sponsor some of, and actually I'm reverse mentored by a young Nigerian lady called Tutu, who's amazing, right? Because, you know, one of the things that I mean, it's easy for me to mentor and sponsor women because I'm a woman and I can walk in their shoes easily and I can see how an environment that I find very easy to navigate, you know, bullshit misogynistic men, you know, for some women is actually a very overwhelming and really knocks at their confidence, you know, and so, but what I have realized, particularly in the last 12 months, is that it's much harder for me. I can walk in the shoes of people from, you know, different socioeconomic backgrounds. I can walk in the shoes of other women. I can't walk in the shoes of young black people in Britain because that's not my life, right? And I can empathize around some of the potentially socioeconomic challenges that they may or may not face. I can empathize about being a woman, but I can't understand what it is to be black. And so I thought, I don't really know how I'm going to address this. And so I'm a non-exec director on a FTSE 250 company. And they were talking about reverse mentoring. And I said, oh, could you get me a reverse mentor? And I was this amazing young woman. And she has just helps me, you know, she helps me as much as I help her. I get to talk to her about career stuff and how to navigate the bullshit that is work. And she gets to help me understand that. So I think there is that sort of mutuality now, I'm a bit older, that's coming into bear. Mm. But I would say if I had to give like a sort of one motto, because I like a motto, as I said, so I suppose, you know, you put me on the spot, Amy, let me see if I can deliver. I'd say call it out.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. So I'm amazed by how many people will talk about things that are happening in friendship groups, WhatsApp, you know, to other people at the water cooler. It's not okay. You've got to call it out.
Mm.
And you know, so that's one, I'd say. The other one is, so call it out, take control, right? And the other reason I say this is because if you go into a meeting room, so this is one particular, I'll give you one particular example of someone who I've worked with for many years and, you know, we're great mates now, but actually, you know, I've probably been her sponsor. I was her sponsor for many years. She doesn't need me anymore because she's like more successful than me. So she's probably my sponsor now, I'd say. So that's a reverse. There we go. But I always remember her saying she was one of these amazing doers. She could get stuff done anywhere. And like, I'd be like, oh my God, you're just so amazing getting stuff done. But she'd go about it quietly. Like she was like, we all know these people. They come into a meeting room. There's all these big egos in the room and they're all talking at each other. This person doesn't really contribute in the room, but afterwards makes everything happen behind the scenes and gets it all done, right? Quite often women. not always, but quite often. And, you know, in the room, you know, would never fully participate. And the rooms were quite, you know, let's go back to the culture I grew up in. They're quite combative. You know, I'm very happy in those rooms, but, you know, other people with less confidence, not so. And we were having a chat about it. And I said, but, you know, you have a seat at the table. You've got to use it. Right. Hmm? She was like, well, I don't feel comfortable. You know, it's not a game I like playing. It's like, you know, it's like a game of rugby. They're beating each other up and then they're going to the pub afterwards. And it's like, it's really intense and it's not collaborative. It's just competitive and it's this and it's that. And I was like, all right, we'll go first. Set the tone. Don't wait to react to the bullshit you don't like. Put yourself on the agenda. There's a fucking agenda. Write to someone and say, I'd like to go first, please. And set the tone of the meeting. And you'll be amazed how different it will be if you set the tone. You know, they may all go off and behave in the same way, but you have got the thing. You've been able to take control. You've set the tone. You've gone in. And at least then people know what you've been responsible for. And so that would be my two bits. Call it out and take control. And I don't mean by take control. You don't have to behave like they behave. There are many more ways of taking control than at first sight. It isn't about, you know, mirroring the behavior of the other individual. That's not what it's about. That's not how you win control. You know, you've got to recognize what you're not comfortable with there and just be smart about designing situations that put the control into your shoes. And everyone, and this is regardless of your position in a company, right? You don't have to be the named leader on an organization to be the leader in that team. Leadership is not something that comes with title. It absolutely isn't. You can take control in any situation if you take the time to figure out how what's wrong with the situation, how can you fix the problem, and how can you get out of it what you need. It's just a bit of reflection, a bit of taking the time to design it differently and then take control. Anyway.
I love so much of what you just said, and actually your point to get ahead of them, get in there first. And I think that's something that I've definitely done over the last few years of my career, having felt a bit like that, having felt like I don't want to play that game. Okay, get ahead of it. And I probably said it on the podcast before, but one of the tips I've had for people is if you go to an event, get yourself on the stage, like get yourself on the panel, because again, you're getting ahead of it. And people are, especially again, for young women or people who don't quite look the same, or if you might be a bit more timid, you don't like the networking side of things. And that allows you to be like, no, I'm here, I've got something to say. People then come to you, you know, you've set that tone. So I really like that, because I think I hadn't really realized exactly how I was doing it, but on reflection, listening to you saying that, it's like, oh yeah, that's really worked for me as well. And then
reframe it. If you don't like the idea of a network, because it sounds really scary,
yeah,
just reframe it, right? Yeah. And just, I mean, my thing on all of this is like, I thought networking was for boring old boys in the old boys club, right? And I was like, oh, I don't like the sound of that. And, you know, I mean, I always thought of those. Do you remember those chaps at college, Amy, that used to wear the hunting material and go off hunting? And I'd be like, oh my God, what is wrong with these people? Anyway, you know, I was like, I don't want to be part of a network. That sounds dreadful. But what you suddenly realize is, you know, if you reframe it, what I realized really quickly is that because I like solving problems, I like fixing other people's problems, and I like going in and sort of figuring out how I can help. And actually, but I also like a trade. So I like to know it's reciprocal. So actually, when I built my network, I didn't build a network in my mind. I was just basically helping people get stuff done and making sure that the favor was repaid. And that for me felt like a sort of, I didn't realize at the time that that is a network. But what I was doing was just saying, if I do this, you're going to help me with this, right?
Mm.
And actually, that ended up being my network. And the beginnings of it.
You're so right. That's it. Yeah. And you look back and you go, oh, I did that. And then hang on a second, why are they doing this for me? And you're like, oh, that's because that's how it worked. Also, the idea of community. I as you were talking then, I was suddenly just like, oh, we don't mind the word community though, like network, you know, and sometimes it is just that's slight new language. Anyway, so my question to you was to, I really wanted to reflect on the idea, I've been thinking about this for the whole interview, of slow and steady, and you know, your Tortoise Media, and of course that's about slow media, but I think that it seems to be a bit of a theme, and in particular when you said I'd kind of marked out the decades like this, one of my mentors a couple of years ago said the same thing to me, and it changed my perspective and allowed me to be maybe a little more patient, I'm not sure, or have a bit more perspective around the journey. Again, is that something that you, this kind of idea of slow and steady, and you said it about the, again, I'm repeating myself, but the 8 years of like knocking your head against the wall. There's a degree there of feeling like this is a really grounded, purposeful movement that doesn't always have to be really fast. Is that a theme, or am I just projecting something onto you? Because I
think, Becky, you're projecting yourself onto me, right? Because I am a hare.
Interesting.
In a tortoise shell, in a carapace. And the reason I say that is,
okay,
there are different types of people, right? I am a move towards person. I have a big hairy goal right over there, and that's all I give a shit about.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just go, and I am resilient, and I am focused, and I will, and I want to win, and it is about winning, and winning not for the sake of the, but for the goal, right? It's like I'm really mission oriented. But my goals are not easy to achieve in a short time frame. My goals are quite over here, right? So I don't realize that I'm being slow and steady. In fact, I am so impatient, right? And so within that cycle there, it's only when I look back do I realize how far I've come.
Mm.
So for me, I am like furious, hare-like, always on it, like 100% energy, like right all the time. And what I realized, and it's like I look back and I'm like, oh, actually I have achieved what I set out to achieve, but it took me a really long time. And if you told me it was going to take me, you know, 30, so I was 30 years of age when I stopped worrying about money for the first time in my life. If you had told me at 15
mm-hmm.
that it was going to take me 15 years to be in a position where I didn't worry about money,
yep,
I've given up.
I think we all recognize that for sure. I definitely do. Being in those positions,
like, so I think I'm definitely not a tortoise in attitude, but I'm and behavior. But you're absolutely right. And also to those people that say be patient, I've got another story for you, and it'll take a couple of minutes. I'm sorry, we've run over. But I was about, the best thing that happened in my career came out of somebody telling me to be patient and me thinking no. And so I was 29, nearly 30, and I was the number two in the marketing department of the Times. I had left digital, right? Because in digital, I'd been trying to get the paywall through, and they'd been saying, no, 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 no. And I said, well, I can't work in the part of the business that I think is killing the bit of business that makes us money. So I'll go into marketing. So I'm number two in marketing. I say to my boss, I'm a bit bored. You've got me doing promotions, deal making, the bingo girl in me. I'm always good at doing a deal. So I was doing all the deal making, but a bit bored. I'd done it for years. And I said, well, I'd really love to learn subscriptions or maybe brand marketing. I'd like to sort of kind of, and my boss was like, no, I like doing those things. So I was like, oh, all right. And I said, well, can I go and speak to your boss, like the general manager? And so, yeah, go and speak, you know. I said, fine. By this time, as you notice, I've realized that it's good to ask your boss rather
than, I said, no cupboard involved.
No cupboard, exactly. I have learned from the cupboard experience. And so I go and see the general manager. Lovely man, absolutely gorgeous man called Paul. And Paul says to me, look, Katie, you need to learn to be patient or go get yourself a job elsewhere. So the Barclay brothers had just bought the Telegraph. They'd fired most of the people there. There was a new CEO in the seat. I called him up 10 minutes after the meeting, arranged to meet him for breakfast the next day at the Ritz. We went in because the Barclay brothers own the Ritz. We went and had breakfast in the Ritz. Weirdly, another man called Murdoch, but first name Murdoch, not surname Murdoch. Murdoch McLennan, CEO of the Telegraph. And I'm like, well, I think you probably need a marketing director, don't you? Bearing in mind, I'm number two in marketing. I'm not a marketing director. And he says, oh, I do, actually. And I said, well, I'd like to put myself forward for the job. This is what I do. He said, oh, yeah, fine. Yeah, you've got the job. What do you want to earn? I said, and I thought, oh, I have no idea. So I just doubled my salary in my head. And he's like, yep, that's fine. I was like, oh, shit, I should have trebled it. And he gave me the job. This is it. I get back to my desk. At lunchtime, the contract has come through. So in less than 24 hours from my conversation with my boss and then his boss, where I'd been told to be patient to go get another job, I resigned to go and be the marketing director of the Telegraph.
Fantastic.
And I got gardening leave 3 months.
Wow.
So that was rather marvellous. And it was the... there is something about knowing who you are. So let's go to your mind styling piece, right? Which is, I know who I am. I know what makes me tick. I know that patience is not my virtue. I don't try and fix my weaknesses. I play to my strengths. I surround myself with other people who are really good at the things I'm bad at, because I don't want to be patient, because there are enough patient people in the world. I'm brilliant on them, right? But it bores the shit out of me, and I will never be a patient individual. I am impatient. I want change. I want to change it now. The reality is, it takes a very long time to change anything. Hence why I'm a hare inside a tortoise's carapace.
And what are you bringing, therefore, our closing piece, to tortoise? The hare in the tortoise.
Well, my other co-founder, James, is just as hare-like as I am. So, I mean, I think... I don't really know how we ended up in a tortoise, but anyway. Do you know what's really lovely about it? Is that in James, James is one of those editors that I worked with. I worked with him for a couple of years. We did something amazing together. He's a brilliant human being. He's a lovely human being. And on the sort of game that I would play with one of my old colleagues, I've worked with 45 editors in my time, right? And you've got the list of your favourite editors, but the best editors. Normally, inverse correlation. In the case of James, he was one of our favourite editors and one of the best editors, right? And that is a very, you don't get many chances in your life to work with people that you love but also admire. And when that comes around, you just take it, right? And so what do I bring to tortoise? Well, most startups fail. Apparently, older entrepreneurs are more successful than younger entrepreneurs. So I think the reality is, heading as we are, James has already gone to the 50, heading as I am to 50, I think that we're going to lean into the fact that our experience and our hare-like personalities in the tortoise carapace mean that if one in four startups are successful, we want to be that one.
Great. So just to finish off, have you got a final top tip for, and it can really be for anyone who might be listening, but I'm thinking based on what you've just said, any top tips for people who are kind of got that itching to be an entrepreneur, but they might be putting up walls and being like, oh, well, no, I've been in corporate for my whole career, or I'm someone like me can't do this, or anything like that. But any top tips for entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs?
No, not really, because I think you can have a brilliant job, career, life in a corporate or in an entrepreneurial environment. I think the most important thing is you're doing something you believe in and that brings you joy. And, everyone's personal circumstances are different, right? So in mine, my barrier was knowing that I could financially not worry about doing it, but that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the bigger advice to the listeners would be, you know, we're living their 100-year life. Don't do something that you don't love and that doesn't bring you joy.
Thank you.
Go and have an amazing, joy-filled weekend. Thank you.
If the sun stays, if the sun stays out, Amy, I will, because I've realised that I definitely have a correlation in mood between pissing down with rain and sun, particularly in lockdown.
So we can't always control the situations that are going on outside of us, but we can be in control of how we react to those situations.
And that is what mind styling is all about.